Talked about 3 years ago, I think, when your Relics of Rajavihara campaign was up, or around there. I'm not sure if it was exactly then.
Yeah, I think it was around that time. Yeah, looking back on when we talked, it was just over 3 years ago. So that probably would have been the time that that Relics was on Kickstarter or in or about there.
Yeah. So tell me, since then, what has changed? Currently, you've got a campaign called Mind Curse. Which looks really good. Can you tell me about that?
Sure, of course, yeah. I've been busy the last few years working on a lot of other games, but Mayan Curse is our game that's currently on Kickstarter. It's an adventure type of a game. It's competitive, 1 to 6 players, and it's a game where you have to basically solve puzzles to make progress and get back out. So the theme is that there's an ancient city, but you can only see it from the distance from this this large temple. But to get there, you have to draw sacred stones, which have symbols on them, mind symbols, slide slabs to line them up, move across them, collect knowledge about the ancient city along the way, and try to get up to the top of the temple and get back out. But the problem is, the further you progress, the harder it's going to be to get out, because these boulders start rolling back towards the entrance, almost Indiana Jones style. And if you don't get out before all three block the entrance, you are trapped there forever. So it's not just about getting the most knowledge, but also getting out while you still can.
Yeah, perfect. That's a great pitch. I definitely see the Indiana Jones theme both in this and in Relics. That's very cool. And I see that both of the games are puzzle games. What do you think makes a good puzzle? And what are some of the difficult parts of designing a puzzle?
Oh, yeah. They are a challenge to design, for sure. But I think what makes a good puzzle game is something that is solvable, of course, but will have you keep you coming back for more. And, the challenges should increase over time, introduce new complexity, new things, new objects, that type of thing. Like in Relics, for example, every 10 levels you open a new box and there's a new type of lock. So you're discovering something brand new. You don't have to learn everything all up front, but you learn how these crates work and you kind of get a mastery of them, and then you move on. Oh, okay, well, now we've got these other blocks, and how do they work, and how are we going to function around these? And in designing a puzzly type of game like that, there are definitely a lot of challenges. First and foremost, you have to make, levels or scenarios or whatever you're creating that are solvable. It's very easy to create something and then be playing through and it's like, oh, this is really cool. But then realize that, oh, actually, I can't make that one move I need to make in order to solve this. Is this even solvable? So first of all, making it solvable, and then getting the challenge level right, which can be really hard too, because, some people may feel that your game is too easy. Some people may feel that it's too hard, and it's very easy to go in either direction. I know with Relics of Rajavihara, some people felt that, it took a little bit too long to get to some of the harder levels. But some people are like, oh no, this is totally my speed. Like I want to kind of build my way up there. And then with one of our next games, we created 14 Frantic Minutes, which is a frantic race through a lab, connecting all these circuits together, trying to advance on. We found that a lot of people, including some reviewers, really, really struggled, even with the kind of first level, kind of like the easier normal mode. They couldn't even get past that. So we really had to suggest that, you get familiar and comfortable with all the puzzle pieces that you have to use to connect, because once you're more familiar with them, you have a better idea of what can actually be used where and when. And if you get into a certain situation, you won't be like, trying to, hit a square peg through a round hole, because you'll know that, oh, there is no piece that's going to get me around this. I need to find another approach, kind of thing. So it's really a difficult balance of trying to get it to be not too easy, not too hard, and have the challenge level escalate over the course of the game, so it doesn't feel too samey. It feels like you are kind of getting mastery, you are getting better at the game, and you're ready for a higher level of challenge.
Yeah, I've realized I've done one very small puzzle game called Combat Protocols for a game called Token Terrors, and there I realized how you forget what it's like to be a beginner in the puzzle. Like, as the designer, you get really good at it and you're like, oh, this should be easy, right? And then when you watch somebody else struggle with it, it's it can be a little bit of a surprise. And
yeah,
so
I definitely go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say that like getting those levels right, so that, you know, like a learning curve, and, you know, making sure that there is, you're introducing the mechanics, but then like making them more challenging. I found that to be really tough, even in my very limited experience with a puzzle.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely found that, especially in 14 Frantic Minutes, where I played the game more than 100 times, probably a couple hundred times, solo and with other players. And I got very, very good at, you know, knowing the pieces, where they're going to go. I have a bad memory, so it's not like I've memorized the levels or how they work or anything, but I can look at it and be like, okay, well, you know, I think these pieces will fit around here. Okay, maybe not. Let's go around this way. And I can kind of piece it together and solve it and get through all the levels. But for a beginner, it's a very, very different experience, because everything's all new, especially in a game like that where it's real time and you don't have that much time to think. You don't have the familiarity with it. So that's when it really comes down to just making sure you play test the game with a lot of other people and see what it's like for those people the first time they go through it. Is it too easy? Is it a good introduction? You really got to lean into that and make sure you're playing with different people. And then, try with people who have played it a little bit before, and then say, okay, now is this a good next level of challenge? And if you can get some people to kind of play it through kind of from start to finish or at all different difficulty levels, they can really give you the feel for, yeah, it ramped up nicely, or, oh, it got like way too hard too quickly, or I need more of a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah. That brings me to something I've quoted you probably hundreds of times. So yeah, I think the last interview was about 3 years ago. So that'd be about once a week. And I think that's, that's correct. Is I think you said, that games are made by a community. So like they're a community process. And I'm almost certain that you said that. If not, every time I've quoted you, I have said that's what Joe Slack said on my podcast. But I think that is super important. And it's something that really stayed with me from the last time we talked. And I've come to find more and more true as time goes on.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely would wholeheartedly agree with that. I'm sure I have said that, because I know I have said that at other points in the past. So yeah, I mean, you can't make a game on your own. It's just not going to turn out that great. It might be okay. It might be something you enjoy. But until you get that feedback from everybody around in your community, that's what's going to really make your game great.
Yeah. Can you tell me about how you go about playtesting your game and how you develop your game?
Sure. So usually I just start out by myself. You know, I've got an idea. I want to see how this works. And I try to make, you know, the most minimum viable prototype. So with something like Relics of Rajvihara, it was just getting some dollar store blocks and making a very quick grid and a couple meeples, start moving things around and kind of seeing how it works, seeing if there's something fun there, what can be improved, what really needs to go. And then, you know, I want to make sure it's actually functioning when I'm playing myself before I really show it to anybody else, at the very least. And then if it's something I'm going to be working on with a co-designer, I might show it to them and get their feedback on it, see where we can go from there. Or if it's something I'm just working on my own, take it to a game design group, or maybe, you know, play it with my wife or, you know, some friends, something like that, just to get some early feel for if it's going in the right direction. What can be improved? What can be made better? And then it's just really becomes an iterative process from there. Whether I'm playtesting it online or playtesting it in person, just, you know, putting it in front of different groups, trying something out, getting their feedback, and then finding, okay, that part's not working. Okay, let's try taking that out. Sometimes changing things on the fly, especially if you have people who are really comfortable with that, like other designers and people who playtest a lot. You know, they might be totally fine with just saying, oh yeah, like let's cut this part out here, or okay, we're going to get rid of that card because it's way too powerful. I'll give you something else, or change resources. But sometimes it's just a matter of kind of seeing how things are going and then realizing, okay, there's some issues here, and then going back to the drawing board and making some tweaks, trying some different things, playing with another group, and just seeing if it's moving forward or not. And, you know, as long as it's moving forward, you're doing great. Sometimes you have to take something out and you wind up putting it back in or going in another direction. But what I try to do is really always try to stick to my vision for a game. So right when I start off an idea, I usually have a feeling that I want players to have, whether it's going to be like an intense kind of thing or just kind of a relaxed thing. If I want players to really work together, what it is I really want players to experience. And that really drives my decisions, because you can get a lot of feedback from people saying like, oh, I want more attacking. I want more resources. I want more of this. You have to kind of dive a little deeper and say, well, why is that? Is it because you don't feel like you have enough stuff in the game? There's not enough things to do. You want to do more combos, whatever it is. And then see how that aligns with my vision, because you can definitely go down so many different rabbit holes. You know, you can go in 10 different directions, but are they in line with what you want for your game, what you want the players to experience? If they're not, then they may be a really great idea, but maybe it's a totally different game. So you want to really stick to kind of what your vision is for your game, unless that game is just completely not working and you just decide, you know, I want to try this other thing and maybe it makes the game better. But generally, you want to have a vision you're sticking towards, and then the mechanics, the theme, the name, all those other things can change as long as you're kind of going for that same experience.
Yeah, that's something. Like with me, I've found lots of times that vision becomes more apparent as I playtest. And like, it's not in the beginning, maybe I know something very small, you know, about the game. Like maybe I have a theme or something like that. And I'll base it maybe on some mechanics that I want. Or very often what I'll do is I'll have this game meets that game. And then kind of try and, you know, put them together and then see how that works. And then that'll become its own thing. But I find that I don't usually have a super clear vision in the beginning. Do you think that is it for you just following a very specific vision, or does it become clearer as you go on?
I think it can depend. I think in a lot of cases, I have an idea for what I want players to experience and feel. So I can kind of just stick with that. But some other games, I may just have a mechanic. I may just have a theme. And I'm trying to layer things on to try to make it a more fully fleshed out game. So I may not know immediately what that vision is, but maybe as I'm playing it through, I'm getting kind of a feeling. I'm like, okay, this is like really puzzly. Like I'm going to see like people feel like really clever if they can figure this out, or maybe, oh, this is like really like tense. And this is like a tense experience that I want players to have. And sometimes it just kind of comes out in those, you know, early play tests, trying things out, seeing what mechanics and theme really mesh together, and then you get the feeling for that. So it's not always necessarily like right off the bat I know exactly what I want to do with it, but it comes together, and that becomes the focus after I've got, you know, the initial things kind of worked out.
Yeah It's like for me, it's looking for like where's the fun in the game. And oh, yeah. I think that's really useful. Like when you find the fun thing, then double down on it and like make everything work around it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about, because you're publishing your own games now, right?
Yeah, I do. I take kind of a hybrid approach. So I publish about one game a year under my own brand, under Crazy Like a Box. And then there are other games that I make as well that I feel are maybe a better fit for another publisher. Because, you know, doing this full time, you come up with lots of game ideas, and it's, you know, more than I could ever produce. And sometimes, you know, if it's like a party game or maybe like a Euro game, it doesn't really fit with the other games that I'm doing. So I also do pitch to other publishers as well, and have a number of games signed and published with other publishers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can you tell me what the challenges of publishing a game are, or what you've learned in, I think this is your fourth Kickstarter, is that right?
Fourth successful one, fifth. Yes. Overall. So I've had four successes and one learning experience, we'll say. So yeah, learned a ton over that time. I think one of the big things I learned from my first one was I already knew that it was really important to have an audience, to have people there that were interested in your game, but I didn't realize like to what extent you really, really need that. Like you can't rely on friends and family and a few people that have played your game here or there. Like you really, really need to build up your audience, find people who will be interested in your game. Because otherwise you're going on there and you're competing against, you know, thousands of other games and just hoping that some people will see it. But if you can have at least enough of an audience to help you to get funded on day one or at least day two, then it just really kind of kicks like the Kickstarter algorithms into gear and allows more people to see. Because once your game is funded, you know, people will see it, people will notice it, and people like to back a winner as well. There's psychology behind that as well. If you see a game that's sitting there at, you know, 10% funded after a day, you're kind of thinking, well, you know, it's probably not going to hit its funding goal unless something, you know, dramatic happens. It's really, really important to focus on that first day or two, get that audience built up, and try to launch with success so that when other people see it, they see it's already funded. Maybe you're already working towards stretch goals. They see, you know, the content you're putting out and good reviews. There's just so many aspects of it. Working with good content creators and reviewers to help get the word out so other people see your game that might not otherwise see it. The aspects of social media, presenting your game really well, talking about it, coming on podcasts like this and talking about your game and talking about your experience. You know, some people really like to see behind the scenes kind of thing. So if you can show them, you know, how the game was made, earlier versions of the game, maybe write a designer diary for Board Game Geek, doing things like running ads, particularly Facebook ads. And this time around, I'm doing Board Game Geek ads for the first time. So that's a bit of a different experience and seeing how they work. But, you know, a lot of it is, you know, trying different things, getting the word out, getting your game out there. Of course, it requires you to make a great game. That's kind of a prerequisite that you have a great game, particularly something that looks good. If you're doing crowdfunding, people do judge your book by its cover. And if your game looks kind of dry and you know, it's not very exciting, it's going to be a little bit of a harder sell than something that has really great table presence, amazing looking components, some really nice art, something really like stands out in your game. So the more you can make your game look like it stands out from all the other games out there, the better chance you're going to have. And then, of course, communication is such a huge thing. Communicating with the people who, you know, saw your ad, joined your email list, who backed your game, whether it's during your campaign and afterwards, really listening to them. You know, you can't give everything that everybody suggests. You can't promise the moon because you're going to wind up, you know, going into debt or including some components you hadn't thought about beforehand, and they're going to add a lot of weight for your shipping, or maybe it requires more development work because somebody wants, you know, a solo mode or a 5 or 6 player mode, and you haven't done that, and you're going to wind up, you know, really, you know, dragging your campaign or dragging your development time out much further. So just trying to have everything in place for when you launch, so you know it's the best game it possibly could be, but also listen to that feedback, because there are some ideas that will come out, maybe about changing something up in your components, maybe making the look of something a little different, maybe something looks a little too similar. Like for Mayan Curse, for example, two of the symbols looked a little too similar, so we're going back and tweaking them to make sure that they stand out, different colors, different configuration, just little things like that, and communicating with people to let them know where you're at in the process, how things are going. If you run into problems, you know, let people know about them. Let people know about the issues and how you're going to solve them, how you're working towards them and trying to reach that established or estimated date of delivery. It's all about keeping people in the loop and letting them know you're listening to them, even if you can't introduce everything that they would like to have in the game.
Yeah. And for you, because I know it differs a lot, although people expect more and more, I think, as Kickstarter consumers, because you have like huge publishers going on using the same platform, I think there is an expectation of the game being guaranteed, of course. But how far along in development would you be comfortable going into a campaign? And that's like in terms of art, in terms of game design, in terms of like how, in order to be open to those ideas from the audience, you know, you need to, I think you need to have space where you're okay with those changes. So what to you, how far along does a game need to be, and what needs to be done, what needs to, or what can be not finished yet when you go on a Kickstarter?
I like to have my game as close to finished as possible, but like you said, be flexible around people's ideas. You know, it could be around some minor changes to some components, some upgrades, maybe changing something from cardboard to wood, moving things around, rearranging things. So I like to present a game that looks finished and is, you know, fully developed, all the modes. You know, it can be a red flag if you have a game and then, you know, at some point during the campaign, you're like, oh, we're going to unlock a solo mode or something like that. Because for people who play solo games a lot, that seems like a red flag, because it seems like, have they actually thought this out? Is it actually developed? Or is it just like hinting at, you know, we want to develop this? You know, I want to have all those things in place. They may not be 100% perfect, right before our Mayan Curse campaign, we were still just finalizing the solo scenarios. And, you know, there's a chance we could still, you know, tweak them a little bit, change them up a little bit. The components as well. We've had great suggestions on that for little things that we can change. Like I said, changing some of the art, changing some of the iconography a little bit. I think it's nice to be open to those suggestions for things that aren't going to change your game drastically. Now, if people want to introduce something that's going to, you know, require another 6 months of development or something like that, then that means your game is not going to be delivered when you said it's going to be delivered. So I think you have to be careful not to try to take something on or make a promise that you can't keep or that's going to really change all your timeline. So I like to have the game developed as best as it can be at that point when it launches, art as close as I can have. I mean, there might be still some things coming in, and that's not a bad thing to have some art coming in during your campaign too, because that's something you can share. You can say, oh, you know, we've you know, created a new sketch for this character in the game, or we redesigned this to make it look more colorblind friendly or something along those lines. So you can have those things as updates, as things you can share on the campaign and in social media. But I like to have my game as close to production ready as I can, so that we can move towards, you know, getting the sample, getting the physical copy, testing it out, making sure that everything's good. Because sometimes you'll get something back from manufacturer and realize you have to make some changes there. So you need some flexibility, some time there, and before you move into your mass manufacturing and then shipping and everything from there as well. And that's part of also in the planning process, making sure you allocate more than enough time from the time your campaign ends to when you want to deliver, because things can come up. Sometimes it can take longer to go back and forth with the files, and maybe your graphic designer needs to work on some things and they're working on a bunch of other projects, so they can't necessarily prioritize, you know, your changes. So you need to allocate time for all those changes. And then also the pleasant surprises that might come along, like we've experienced having a publisher from another country come in and say, oh, I really like the look of this game. Can we see a sample? We might be interested in licensing this, say, in French or in Spanish. And then, you know, you bring them on board and they need some time to evaluate and do a translation and sign contracts and that kind of thing. And then the benefit of that too is if you have, you know, you're going to print 2,000 copies of the game and they want to print 2,000 copies of the game, that's 4,000 copies. Now you can get a better price, depending on how language dependent your game is. But if it's just, say, the rule book and the box, then, you know, a lot of all those other components, now you're printing twice as many. So you can get a better cost advantage for that kind of thing as well. So I think, you know, it's always important to leave yourself a buffer in that space and leave yourself open to those opportunities from other publishers, from other backers who have those ideas, so that you have some flexibility as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you still teaching game design, by the way?
Yeah, I do run my own online course. So I have the board game design course where I help students kind of go through, take their idea from start to finish, developing a game and play testing. And we have twice a month Q&A calls with all our members, so they can ask questions about their specific game or theory or anything that they have going on. And I also run twice a year a creation to publication program for people who have made their game and they want to get it published. They don't want to do it themselves, but they're having a hard time finding a publisher. So I walk through all the steps for, you know, making sell sheets and videos and how to approach publishers, the right matches for publishers. And I also have a crowdfunding success course as well for people who want to kind of go this route and publish their own game, how to go about building their audience, creating their game and the look and the feel for it, and running a successful campaign as well.
Yeah. Well, you're very busy.
Yeah, never a slow time.
Yeah. In teaching game design, what are some practical things that people can do?
I think the first thing, like I've already alluded to, is to make their first minimum viable prototype really quickly. I think that's one of the key things, because so many people have, you know, an idea for something, whether it's a game or a song, whatever it is that they're working on. But if you don't actually, you know, put it on paper, try it out in front of yourself, you're just thinking about it. You're not actually creating anything. So I think that's like the really, really key step, is to make a minimum viable prototype. You don't have to make everything. You don't have to make, you know, 300 cards and all these recessed player boards and everything. Just, you know, get some components from other games, mock something up really quickly, try it out, just see how it works. And then you can make tweaks and revisions and go from there. And like I was saying, once you get kind of an idea for what your game is going to be, where you're going to go with it, have that vision, because that's going to really help, you know, guide you through those decisions. Because you're going to get some people saying, I want more attacking. And some people say, I want less attacking. Like, which direction do you then go? Well, if you can always go back to your vision, it's like, what does the vision say for the game? And then you always have a path you can go down, which makes it a lot easier, because, you know, you can, like I said, you can go in 10 different directions, but you want to know which direction is the most likely path to the, you know, success of your game being really fun and an engaging experience. And then just getting it out in front of other people, not just, you know, your friends and family, but people who don't know you, people who will have unbiased feedback for you, who will be very honest and will tell you, you know, what's terrible about your game, what they really like about your game, how it needs to be changed, and develop that thick skin so you can sit back and say, okay, thank you so much for your feedback. You don't necessarily have to take every piece of advice or every suggestion to change your game, but listen to what they're saying. And especially if you're hearing something over and over and over again, it's one thing if it's a one-off thing, you know, in 100 playtests, one person mentioned something, maybe that's just what they're looking for in the game. But if it's something coming up over and over again, the turns are taking too long, this, you know, these combos aren't working, there's something unbalanced here, this card's overpowered, whatever it is, you have to listen to that, because you're hearing it over and over again. It's not just one opinion, you know, it's an actual issue with the game. So be willing to take that feedback, to listen to those things, make those changes, even if it was a really core thing of your game. Sometimes that core idea has to go. And sometimes just testing it without that one piece and realizing that the game plays just as well or maybe even better without that piece, maybe that's something for another game. And being okay with that and being able to move on, because you want your game to be the best it can be and you don't want any of those things holding it back.
Yeah, for sure. That's happened to me. It happened to me very recently, where I kept getting a comment about a specific part of the game being not thematic. And but one of my like core principles for that game was to keep it as simple as possible. And I felt that ignoring theme in that case was keeping it simple. And that's actually something that I'm still dealing with. I haven't quite solved in that case, but it's definitely, you know, when you hear something multiple times, you need to think about addressing it or how you're going to address it. Or if you choose not to address it, you should have some, you know, strong reasons.
Yeah. And it's a tough thing. Like I've definitely been in that position where I've heard something a few times and I'm like, but I really like that thing, or I thought that was really cool, but no, it's holding something back. So let's try it without and let's see, you know, where it goes. And if it makes it a better game, then yeah, maybe that needs to go. As much as you want to hold on to that thing and you think that one thing is really, really important to it, maybe it's not as important as you think, because the players are telling you that, you know, that's not what is making the game for them. That's not the key experience, that fun moment for them.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. You mentioned that what you do with your students is you have them make a game from beginning to finish. And I find that that's something that so many people struggle with, is making a finished game. And for me as well, maybe I'd say maybe about 30% of the games that I've started, I have finished, you know, either published or I've either decided this is not going to, like, this is the final stage of the game. And how important is that, and how do you get to a finished state, and when can you call something finished?
Yeah, and it's tough because, like you're saying, every game doesn't need to get finished. There are plenty of games that I've, you know, started and realized, you know, it's not that much fun, and it might have, you know, 5 or 10 other games on the go, and I have to decide, you know, which one am I going to focus the time on. And if this game's just not going anywhere, it's just going to take some time, I'm totally fine with just putting that on the shelf. Maybe an idea will come to me later. Maybe it never will. Maybe it's not meant to be. So I think you also have to be comfortable putting something on the shelf and saying that, you know, this isn't as good as something else I'm working on, or it's just not functioning. Maybe there's something there, but, you know, you can't just keep, you know, hitting your head against the wall trying to fix it. Sometimes you have to set it aside. But I do always encourage new designers to take a game from start to finish, because it's so easy to come up with another idea and this new shiny thing, and then start working on that. And then you'll get another new shiny thing. And so before you know it, you have 10 games that are, you know, 10% done. Whereas you could have, you know, one game brought from start to finish. And it's really hard because ideas are great. And once you start designing games, you're just going to keep having more and more and more ideas. So I really encourage people to say, that's great, you have a new idea, write it down, write down all the details for it, so you can come back to that later. But right now, you need to focus on this one game you're working on, and, you know, play test it and develop it and make it the best that it can be. And sometimes it takes a developer or a publisher to take it that last mile. And that's totally fine, because if you've been working on your game for, like, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years, you're going to get to a point where you're like, I can't personally make this any better. This is the best game that I can make out of this. And be okay with that, because maybe you're going to find a publisher you can hand this off to that's like, yeah, this game's like almost there, and they will do that final development work for you. But I think there's just so much power in and so much feeling that you get from being able to take a game to completion as far as you can make it and say, you know what? I made a game, not just I had an idea, I made something, but I actually made and finished a game. Because then you can move on and say, okay, I've developed some chops, I've got some experience, I know some things that work and some things that don't work. Then you can move on to that next game. Go back to that list that you've had for all these other ideas and go work on the next one that you're most excited about and start to work on it. And at that point then, you know, if you have a little more time and you're working on games a little bit faster, then you can have a second and a third game you're working on. And that's a really great thing to have as well. When you get past that first game, I always love to say, you know, get that first game under your belt, even if it doesn't get published, even if it doesn't go anywhere, but just to say you've taken it from start to finish, then you've got all these other games you're working on. You could have one at kind of an early idea stage where it's, you know, really exciting because you're, you know, trying all these new things. Then you got one that's a little bit further along and you're able to take it to playtesting sessions. And then maybe one that's, you know, further along that you're kind of closing in on the end stage, because you can bounce around between those. So if you're stuck on one thing, maybe you don't have another playtest night for another week. Well, you can work on this other aspect. You can work on the rule book for the, you know, the game that's almost complete, or you can work on this other idea. So you kind of bounce back and forth and also learn from those experiences, because often you'll be like, oh, I remember I had this problem in this other game, or as you're playtesting other people's game, I saw that they had this exact same issue and they solved it this way. So by playing other people's games, other people's prototypes, developing yours more, you're going to learn more things, and it's going to come to you a little bit easier. You know, when you run into those problems, those issues, because you're going to see how they've been solved before, and you can say, okay, that worked really well, or I want to try something a little different that hasn't been done before. But yeah, it's really taking that first game from start to finish, because otherwise you just got all these pieces, and there's no sense of completion. There's no sense of that you've actually accomplished anything. You've done little bits and pieces of things. And if you get into that habit of doing that, you probably will never finish a game. And you might get frustrated by the fact that you don't have any finished games. You have nothing you can, you know, present to a publisher, nothing you can crowdfund, because everything's at, you know, a 10 or 20% development stage. So yeah. I think it's really important and imperative to get that first game finished, even if it's not a perfect game, a game that's going to be published today.
Yeah, those are some really good points. It's like, I find that's one thing that stops people is they're aiming for that perfection. And yeah, what you don't realize is you can, like, once you finish something, then you can learn from it for your next project. And like, if right now you take it You know, it's not 100% perfect, but maybe it's like at 80%. You're happy with it at 80%. And you say, that's enough. I'm moving on. It's finished. Then your next project, if you take to your 80%, that will be more than what your 100% perfect would have been on that first project. And you can learn from your projects. And I mean, it's also difficult, like if you make a really good game and then your next one, you feel like you need to do better. But yeah, those are some really good points. And for me, something that makes things a lot easier is co-designing. And I have maybe around 4 or 5 projects at a time, which I'm working on with different people, and they're all in various stages. And when we finish a project with one co-designer, we start the next one, and then it's really nice that I can bounce off from one project to another. In fact, one of my projects is with Adrian Adamescu, who you probably know, because I know he's also in the Canadian Board Game Artisans group.
Yeah, and I just listened to the podcast where you were talking with him as well. So yeah,
perfect.
I know Adrian as well.
Perfect. Yeah. But what I find difficult is designing by myself. And I've tried it a couple of times. And I've tried, I entered a roll and write contest a couple of years ago. And I've done a little solo game. But every time I feel like it's so difficult for me not to be able to bounce ideas off of people, or to have that schedule of, okay, we're meeting, you know, every Tuesday at 2 o'clock to work on the game, you know? How do you keep a schedule and keep working on games? And I don't know, for me, it seems so difficult to do it by yourself.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff there. I love working on co-designs. Sylvain Plante is my main co-designer that I work with, and we get together regularly, and it keeps the games moving forward all the time. You're excited about them. You play tested something, and then you always have takeaways. Okay, what are our next steps? Okay, well, Sylvain's going to go and update the board with these things. I'm going to go work on the balance for some of these cards, or create some new cards and that kind of thing. And then when we come together, then we're playtesting it again. And you always have these deadlines and timelines, and you always want to feel like you're contributing. You don't want to feel like, oh, the other person's doing all the work. So you really want to keep things moving forward. And especially if you find a co-designer who will balance really well with you. If you got two people who really like the exact same kind of approach, like if two people are really all about like the balance and the math, then it might not work so well compared to, you know, having a combination of somebody who's really into figuring out the theme and how that really meshes and making the prototype, and somebody who's more into, say, working on the numbers and the cards and things like that. And like, it can all just come together, especially if you like the same type of games, you like the same kind of approach. It can be really, really powerful. And I've designed solo on my own and with other co-designers as well. And I love the experience of working on co-designs. And some games just come together and I already have an idea. I'm like, I don't really need to bring in a co-designer. This kind of already, the concept's already working. I'm going to keep going with it. Or maybe it's a type of game that, you know, one of my co-designers wouldn't necessarily be as interested in. But in terms of like what I'm doing, like I love the fact that every day is different. I've got, you know, so many irons in the fire, or, you know, just different things going on that, you know, one day I might focus on more like admin type stuff. Like I might, you know, write a blog for my website that they post every week and do some more kind of like admin stuff, catching up on things, following up on things, you know, reaching out to publishers, that kind of thing. And then another day I might be spending getting together a prototype ready and then playtesting it online. And the next day I might be meeting with a co-designer. So I'm going to be, you know, bring my games and we're going to, you know, talk about some new ideas and work on the games that we're working on. And then, you know, might just have like a brainstorming day or a day to, you know, just, you know, try some different things, come up with different ideas. So every day is a little different, which I absolutely love. being able to do different things, different days, have some things that are scheduled and have some things that are kind of just like open for creative space and just thinking, okay, well, I've got an idea for something here. Let's, you know, put some meeples down, throw around some dice and see what comes from this. We'll see if there's an actual game here or if it's something I'm going to set aside and work on there. So I love the variety, be able to do different things every day and also collaborating and working with other amazing people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I asked you earlier what's difficult about puzzle design. What are some difficult problems that you've found solutions to in your game design?
Solutions. Let me think. So sometimes you'll just have a game that it's just like there's something not clicking. Like the game's it's good, it's functional. You know, everything's working, it's not broken. But you just can't find like, well, where's the fun? Where's the fun part in this? So that can be a really tricky thing. Because you really have to just, you know, listen to players and see what they're enjoying the most. And sometimes it means, you know, cutting out a lot of other things, a lot of the excess things, administrative type things, like try to have the least amount of fiddliness in your game, where you're having to set things up, change things, you know, reset the whole board every, you know, 5 minutes, that kind of thing. So trying to take out those things that are the less fun, aspects and trying to focus in on what the really fun aspects are, getting players to that really quickly. That can be a challenge because sometimes you don't know where your game's going to go or what the most fun part's going to be until you start playing with different people. Maybe it'll surprise you. Maybe you thought that, you know, this bidding mechanic was really cool, but it's really slow and clunky and it slows the game down. What people like is really like putting things down and making some combos and that kind of thing. So being willing and open to making some changes, seeing what's working and seeing what's not working, not being afraid to, like I said, put something on the shelf. So often you're just working on something and it's not coming together. You've tried, you know, 10 different things to make this one part of your game work and none of them have quite done it. Put it on the shelf. Say, you know, let's work on this other game. Let's not, you know, beat ourselves up about not being able to find a solution. And then, you know, sometime, you know, when you're like in the shower or taking a walk or working on another game, you'd be like, oh, that's what I need to do. That'll work with this. And then taking it back out and saying, okay, let's try it this way. Maybe it's the solution. Maybe it's not, but maybe it gets you one step closer to doing that. So not being afraid to, you know, put something aside and work on the other games that are, you know, working better.
Sometimes we forget that that's an option. Like, or sometimes, you know, you've put so much time into it. And I've had a case where with a co-design, we worked on a game for about a year before we decided to put it on a shelf. And that's like countless. I mean, it's a lot of hours that we put into it, you know, a couple of days a week. And, you know, in the end, we've shelved it. We might take it back at some point. We've definitely learned a lot from it, but it was difficult to shelve because it's like, you know, you really want it to work, but at the same time, you've gotten it to a point where you're like, I know we're currently not happy with this. And maybe we need to work on something else. And it's a tough thing to do, especially if it's your first game, I think.
Yeah, you've invested so much time, so much effort. You know, this is your baby. You want to see it, you know, fully grown and working really, really well. And, you know, sometimes you just have to be willing to say, you know, it's not working right now. Let's put this aside. Let's work on, you know, you've probably got, you know, tons of other ideas. So let's try something else out. There's, you know, that sunken cost fallacy, where you just think, yeah, well, we've already put so much into this. We have to make this work. Like we can't give up. We've put, you know, 300 hours into this game. We can't, say that it doesn't work. And, you know, there's something to that to say, you know, there's gotta be something here. Otherwise we wouldn't have worked on it so far, but you know, you have to sometimes be able to set it aside and say, yeah, let's move on to the next thing. Maybe we'll come back to it. Maybe some idea will spark later on.
Yeah.
And also there's that, we talked a little bit about kind of like the law of diminishing returns. Once you get a game to a certain point, you know, maybe every hour you're putting in, you're making the game 5% better, but you're going to get to some point where like, you're going to have to put in, you know, an extra 10 hours to make it 1% better. Mm-hmm. And is it worth putting in that much more time? Or is it time to say, yeah, we've taken it as far as we can. It's time to either, you know, shelve it, pitch it, you know, hand it off to a developer, whatever you need to do, because you can only take it so much further at this point.
Yeah. Another question I want to ask you is about when you play other games, because I know like, let's say if you want to be a cinematographer or if you want to make movies, I can imagine you watching a movie and not just, you know, being entertained by it, but also thinking, oh, that's a cool shot, you know, or, you know, this is, I can see what they've done with the plot here. And I find myself doing that constantly when playing another game and being like, oh, that's interesting. What can I take from this? Or what would you recommend in how people who want to design games, how should they play games? Should they like turn their designer brain off or on? And should they be more open to different genres of games and so on?
Yeah, I think it can be hard to turn that designer brain off. And I think everybody might be a little bit different in how they approach it. When I play a game, I try to approach it in that, hey, I'm learning this new game. I want to have a great experience. Let's see. I'm playing a game to be, you know, entertained, to be engaged, to do something fun, to enjoy the company of the people around me. So when playing a game for the first time, I try to just immerse myself in the game, trying different strategies, maybe seeing how things work out. There are definitely at some points when I'm playing a game and I'm kind of like, oh, okay, I like what, you know, the designer did with this, like, because, you know, you have to like branch off, and am I going to go, you know, this hard approach? Am I going to go this way? Quite often I'll get to the very end of the game or after the game, then I really get into the analytical side of it, where I'm looking at the game and saying, okay, what design decisions did they make here? Why did they go this route? Or this is something that I thought worked really well, or maybe this part of it I thought could have been better. And then kind of learn from those experiences and say, oh, okay, maybe I'm working on a game and this is how they've made things, you know, flow more smoothly here. Maybe I can learn from this. But at the same time, you know, what are some things that could be, you know, done better in my game design if I'm working on a game where it triggers that. But I definitely do think that people should play a lot of different games. I think it's important to play games that you like, games that are kind of outside your normal realm. So maybe games that are a little heavier, a little lighter, different mechanics, because you're going to learn a lot from them. Even if you're not designing that exact type of game, you're going to come up with something from it. And this can be from good games. You can also learn from bad games. You can learn, you know, to avoid things like ending the game too abruptly, or having a player lose their turn or go back to start or lose all their progress, you know, how that feels. And you don't want to implement that into your game as well. So you can learn a lot from both good and kind of quote unquote bad games or games that are maybe not quite as modern.
Yeah, I've probably learned the most about game design in playtesting unfinished games, because there you see a lot of unresolved problems, and you start thinking, how is that gonna happen, or how is that gonna how can that be alleviated, and like why is it that this game works for 3 rounds but doesn't work for 7 rounds, you know, stuff like that.
Or a different player count. How can this can be so good at, you know, 4 players, but when you get down to 2 players, it's a totally different experience, or it just doesn't feel the same. And those kind of things, you know, stick with you as well when you're designing your game, and you discover that, you know, your game is super, super strong at 2 players. You can play it at 3 or 4 players, but it's not nearly as good. So do you really, you know, hone in and say, this is a 2-player game, this is where it shines? Because you don't want to give people, you know, that experience of, yeah, you can play it at these other player counts or in this manner, but it's really not as good as of an experience.
Yeah. But then also, you've got some really creative decisions around that. Like one thing I really like, I love the game Dune Imperium. I think it's a fantastic game. And what I really love about that game is how they've done the single player and the two player in it is they've actually made it always be at least three players. So if you're playing at two players, you still have an AI. And I thought that was, to me, really creative because it was, you know, usually the solo mode is going to be a two player game, but controlling two AIs in that case, I thought was really cool.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept. And as long as, you know, as long as the automas or the players you're kind of quote unquote playing against are easy to manage and you're not spending, you know, a lot of time, you know, moving things around and doing a lot of housekeeping, you want to focus players on, you know, doing the fun stuff in the game. So if you can make that happen, that's a really interesting concept.
Yeah. Well, with the solo design, I find that you need to make, that's another choice that you need to make. Like, how much of a dummy do you make the dummy player? And because some solo players would prefer, or at least would like to have the option of having a more difficult automa, you know, but one that makes more realistic decisions. And how much do you, you know, lean into that versus having less admin, you know?
Absolutely. And there's different ways to do solo modes too. I mean, one of the standard ones that people tend to not like quite as much as just, you know, beat your high score. I know you're talking about this with Adrian as well. How it's just, you know, there's maybe thresholds, you know, like 30 points is okay. 40 points is great. 50 points is amazing. So you have like thresholds, like something like you do in like Cartographers, for example. Or you can have just, you know, you're just trying to do better every time, like in Gone Sean Clever. And I quite enjoy that game and trying to roll better and do better every time. But for a lot of players and my experience as well, I much prefer having an objective, like, did I accomplish this mission? Yes or no? Like, it's either like a win or a loss.
Yeah.
And it could be different scenarios. You need to accomplish this, this, and this. Did you do it? No, try again. And then kind of, you know, go through more challenging scenarios. So that's something that we introduced in 14 Frantic Minutes, with different levels that you could play in a group or solo. We're going through, and also with Mayan Curse, I really wanted the solo mode to be more than just, you know, get X number of points. We do kind of set a standard for like the normal mode, you want to get this many points, hard mode, you want to get this. But then what really shines is the solo scenario. So once you've played it a couple times and you get a feel for it, then okay, now we want you to try to get all the way to the top of the temple, take a picture with the camera, and get back out. But you're not allowed to go past any of the monuments. So you have to find a very tricky path to get around them. You can't even go past a single one of them. Or you need to collect a certain configuration of different monuments on your way. So every different scenario is unique and different and has your brain working in a kind of a different way for something different you need to accomplish. And I think that's something that's really key in a solo mode is making people feel like, okay, they've got a goal that they need to accomplish. Can they make it or not? And then if it's quick enough to set up and play again, if they lose, they're going to be wanting to play it again and being like, oh, I came so close. Okay, I'm going to do this again and go jump right back into it and play it again.
Yeah, sure. Like a great example of another game that does that is Hadrian's Wall, where in the base game, you've got it's beat your own score, but they've got a BGG campaign that's out that I think is 12 different scenarios and each one has different goals. And I think that improves it so much because you feel that challenge and it's not just the challenge of making points. It's can I make points, but also I have these other restrictions or this other thing that I'm trying to go for.
It really opens up the game, more space for people to try maybe a different strategy that they hadn't thought of, to have to do different things that they didn't have to in the base game and get their brains thinking in a different way, in a challenging way that they'll enjoy.
Yeah, for sure. All right. The final question, I've asked you this before because it's your second time on here, but maybe your answer has changed. What would be your advice to somebody who is just starting out in game design, wants to design their first game?
Again, I'd have to go back to making that minimum viable prototype. Getting that idea out of your head as quickly as possible. making some cards, grab some dice, grab some meeples, whatever you have available to you around the house or in other games, and just try out the idea. See what's working, what's not, and evolve it from there. Once it gets to a point where it's, you know, working well, show it to some other people you know, get their feedback on it, and then take it from there and take it to other designers, game design events, people you don't know, and let your game evolve from there and be open to making changes and making your game the best it can be.
All right, fantastic. Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing Mayan Curse, how the campaign does. Anything else you want to shout out before we finish?
That's about it. Yeah, Mayan Curse is going to be available till November 17th.
Yep, and I'll do my best to get the podcast out as soon as possible so that people have time to back it if they hear the podcast when it comes out.
Wonderful, appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.